Welcome to The Political Nomad. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. Thanks for listening. This week, we're getting the second half of my conversation with JV Aureliano. I really enjoyed talking with JV. It was another one of those conversations where I felt like I had known him for a long time, even though this was the first time we really had a chance to talk. I think you'll enjoy the second half of our conversation. Here's part two.
All right. Let's go to the time machine.
Let's unpack that a bit.
No, but it's good. It's good because I want to go back into the time machine when I first got into online politics in 2010.
Yeah.
My political identity was still firmly conservative, still is. I want to believe that it still is. So around 2010, you got the CPACs, you got the little happy hours. I was working in College Park in D.C., in College Park, Maryland, right? Which is about 25 minutes in D.C., away from D.C. without traffic, 35 minutes with a lot of stoplights. They're horrible. But there was a lot of socializing.
And heaven forbid, you get on 495.
Well, at least coming out of College Park, never. I mean, I would take Route 1 into New York Ave, right?
Yeah.
But there were a lot of schmoozing. There was a lot of socializing. You know, like CPAC wasn't as big as it was, and you know, Rhinocon, where you would go the night before, and it was still a tortilla coast on the hill, and then you know you'd be rubbing elbows with the same people that you were seeing on Twitter, and they were so real, right? And they were sincere at the time, and many of them still are. You know, a lot of them worked for campaigns. A lot of them worked for think tanks. A lot of them worked for campaigns. And you've got the good old grifters. You know, you've got the campaign consultants. You've got the marketing people. That's everybody, right? But I saw that, started socializing, made some really good friends, and I'm still friends with some of them. Actually, most of them. But one of the things that I discovered when I went down there is that, my God, like, I despise the jockeying for position that everybody just put on. And I'm just like, I'm going to walk into D.C., into any kind of party you invite me to, whether it's the MRC Gala, which I attended twice, you know, like Rhinocon, I have gone almost every year. You've had, you know, this heritage party here or that happy hour there. I'm going to walk in there, and you know who I was at the time? I was selling medical equipment over the phone. And I'm just a guy with a Twitter account and a blog. And I had nothing to offer to them. And yet, I made really good friends because I just came in there and I tried to be just as real as possible.
Yeah.
That's all I did. And when I realized just how much ankle biting was going on in D.C., I hated it. I hated the culture there, that idea that you had said, that I have this so-and-so person's ear, that I have this so-and-so person's, like, I can influence this person. The perception of power. The perception of power is intoxicating. It's more intoxicating than power itself. Because when you are able to wield power, when you are able to exert force or influence effectively, you're either a maniac and you destroy yourself in the process, or you become really conscientious about it and you become responsible about it. And the truth is, like, a lot of people with real power in this world, whether you're the guy signing paychecks, or whether you're the guy investing money in something promising, or whether you're the guy with the guns, like, everybody who survives with power understands the responsibilities that come with it. And the thing is, growing up in the Philippines, my final 2 years there, between, you know, like 99 and 2000, I was 19 years old. I turned 20, and then I was coming in 20. So 2000. All right. So last 2.5 years, my final 2.5 years over there, it was really interesting because I had access to so many different people from so many different walks of life. I was friends with gang lords, with people who, you know, I was friends with people who wanted to kill each other, and I kind of used that my common friendship with them to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's power. of a different kind. You know? Like, and they're still alive, and they don't hate each other. They've moved on. But at the time, I'm a 19-year-old guy who was able to bend a couple of ears here and there, just so that people weren't around. Like, people I knew didn't, people I liked didn't kill each other. You know, like, there were people I knew back home who made their fortunes, with white collar crime, but were also very conscientious about not hurting anybody. You know, like, people who would smuggle goods, legal goods, not drugs. Like, they would never do drugs. They would, like, they would never sell drugs, and they would never, they would never engage in human trafficking, but they would procure goods that required such high tariffs that they would rather just, you know, smuggle stuff in and make a good buck. Like, there's some amorality to that that is appealing, in a sense, because it feels almost subversive. But but these people, you know, acquired their wealth, and then they started investing, laundering their money, really. Like, basically moving out of that. They made their initial fortune and then started being restaurateurs and textile, you know, manufacturers, and then and they moved on. Because, but, you know, like, being able to produce, to help other people have a livelihood, to not, like, to provide for it. I don't like that phrase. I hate having to think out loud. But to be able to have a business, let's say you started from a slightly more illegal origin, but then to turn it legit and then make it grow so that you can't go it alone, and you have employees whose lives improve because you pay them a wage that they agree to, right? That's capitalism. Sure, it might, like, coming from a very corrupt country, it starts off at the very bottom, but like but the urge is never to actually wallow in debauchery. Like the, you know, the people I know who ran gangs, these people disbanded their group because they didn't need it anymore. They grew up and they had children, and then they realized they didn't want to kill anybody. Yeah, and they don't have a body count. They never got to that point. You know, it's not LA gangs. It's doesn't compare that way. But for me, to have been exposed early to real power makes a lot of petty perception of power seem so, like, just so unimportant, right? So around 2010 to 2012, when media was such a big thing, like, you know, oh, let's have blogs, let's have this writers network, let's all publish all this stuff, and let's try to make a dime off of it. I am relieved that I did not get into that. I am relieved that to this day I am not a paid anything thinker or a writer. Like, whatever you see on my Twitter account, you know, it's me. Whatever I write on my Facebook, it's not because somebody paid me to do it. And it's not because I want to influence anybody. Like, I don't care about that stuff. I like the truth is, what I like the most is actually planting ideas in people's heads, or at least getting them to rethink their priors.
Yeah.
You know, and it's good. It's good because I can read a person's body language when they start doubting what they've always thought to be true. Because life is too short to, like, you know, to hang on to priors all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah. Sorry if I'm like...
No. I think that's... I think you're spot on there. I mean, because honestly, I look back on those times, because, you know, in many ways I was right there with you. But, and I remember seeing all the backbiting. You know, everyone would be nice to each other, you know, to their face, But then behind the scenes, I mean, there was so much backbiting and infighting that, because they were all jockeying for position in many ways. And I remember wanting to be not a part of the you know, the fighting or anything like that, but, you know, I remember wanting to be a part of that sphere of influence. And it never happened. And you know what? I'm incredibly grateful it didn't. Because I saw that. And I mean, the sad thing is that even if you didn't see it, you could sense it.
Oh, yeah.
Just in conversations with people, or just, I mean, in all the behind-the-scenes shenanigans that was going on between individuals. And it's just like, you know what? I don't want to be a part of this. There are some good people around here that I do want to get to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly wish I had gotten to know you so much earlier. because you would have been right up there. We've followed each other on Twitter for years, but, you know, it's like, you know. But because, you know, it wasn't too long after that I started just, you know, stepping back. Part of it was job-related, but I was just seeing things out there, and I'm like, I can't be that angry all the time. You know, and I can't be shouting from the rafters that this guy is evil because this. You know, because there's always more to the story, but what I was seeing was that we were just going to focus on the one thing, and we were going to manipulate that one thing as much as possible so that we could manipulate other people. And gaslighting has been going on within both parties and within the blogosphere and in all aspects. We're all trying to get each other to believe something, and we're going to demonize whatever we can to make you believe that one thing.
Right, so outrage pimping, right? Like, it's not my thing. I really try not to do that. Like, so call-out culture. Call-out culture was a big thing around the beginning of social media. 2012 was actually one of its higher points, you know, one of the high temperature points of call-out culture. And then, of course, you have cancel culture, which came starting about 2018 and even as early as last year, as recent as last year. I don't peddle in that. I don't. It's just not my thing, you know. I find it ridiculous. And again, like, I've studied enough history to know what struggle sessions are. I've studied enough history to know that it's totalitarian, which is not my thing. So whenever there are people who try to engage that, when they try to peddle in that, I back off. I don't even try to engage. I just leave it be. Because it's not like, you know, the only way to win in a situation like that is not to play. That's all there is to it.
So I guess what, as I look at my list of questions, we've totally gone off, and I actually so appreciate that. You know, I could have just completely thrown this out the window, and that's and I'm happy about that, because that we've had a genuine conversation here. But I guess, you know, this has been going on for a while. So I guess as we get closer to the end here, what I want to know here is, what is going to drive you to the polls this year? I mean, when we look at the age of Trump and Republicanism in the age of Trump, and we look at what the Democrats are tossing out there, and it's a guy who could barely put a whole sentence together. And I say that because I actually feel bad for Joe Biden. He's not in good condition. It's not going to be a fair fight. But how are you approaching politics, the election cycle, in this age of Trump, in this age of COVID-19?
Sure.
I mean,
all right.
and on top of that, what's your advice to those who are listening?
Okay. Gosh. All right. So how am I going
to
approach this?
So many places to go. You got lots of jumping off points.
Okay. So I will maintain that my final choice of who to vote for is going to be private.
Mm-hmm.
Even though if you were to look at my tweets and even if you were to look at my Facebook account, you would probably guess what I'm leading into, like what direction I'm leaning towards. However, I will not declare a vote. I will not declare my vote, and I will never say so who I voted for after the election. That is private for me.
Yeah.
However, mm-hmm. I will say this. I think that there are going to be both groups of voters are going to be voting defensive votes, self-defense votes in November. Mm-hmm. It is going to be there. Almost all voters are going to be voting votes of self-defense or votes of self-preservation. And I will not begrudge or debate anybody who decides to do it that way, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, you'll see a lot of people, you look at Joe Biden, the poor guy, what they're trying to do is basically have a figurehead in there and watch that vice president slot, because he's going to retire 3 months after he wins the election, if he wins, and that's who the president will be. And then you'll have Nancy Pelosi, and you will have Chuck Schumer, and you'll have all these people hovering. And here's the thing. Like, people are able to see through a lot of the BS that is, you know, protecting Democrats in terms of coverage. And so people will be casting defensive votes against them. And I think that however it shakes out, this election is going to be decided on a basis of defensive votes. Nobody is going to vote. Well, I can't say nobody. But there are going to be people who will truly believe that they're voting for Trump, or who will truly believe that they believe that Joe Biden is the right person for the election. But really, it's going to be a series of defensive votes, which means that we're still going to be talking past each other as a country after the election, regardless of who wins. And I think that's the part, like, you know, like we mentioned this earlier, like, we can't even agree that we're looking at the same thing. And that's why we're having such a hard time having conversations. We can't agree on the same facts. We can't agree that we're looking at the same set of facts. And when you do say that you agree, you still think that somebody has bad motives about that. So it's really disappointing. And and the truth is, I think that because we live online, you and me and everybody else who's on Twitter and who's always engaging in the media, the truth on the ground is actually a little bit better. I believe this to be true, that the truth on the ground, communities are actually a little bit better. I think that COVID-19, the quarantines have made them worse for now, you know, because the idea, and I'm gonna soapbox on COVID-19 for a little bit. Do a couple of things, man. Like, one, we were never going to quarantine our way into killing this virus off. Never. It has a 2-week incubation period before somebody realizes they're sick. There are plenty of people who are asymptomatic, and we don't have the testing capability to basically ship a test to every human being on the United States, swab ourselves, and test. It would be nice if we could do that. If we could do that, send every person, you know, 3 tests, do it every 2 days, and then if you test positive, you stay home. But compliance is still not going to be a thing, right? So we were never going to quarantine ourselves into killing this virus off. We were just trying to protect our healthcare workers so that they're not swamped. That said, there are a couple of things. Like certain ideas take root. And there was this one thing, there was this one editorial that I tweeted out earlier about not just flattening the curve, but crushing it. And it's this 10-week, completely idealistic, technocratic fantasy about how we can do this, right? And what you're seeing, for example, with the lockdowns is that there are people who are invested in the idea, the fantasy, that if we would just be compliant, that we would kill this virus. And that is completely untrue, and it's untenable. You know, I have spoken to quite a few people whose only solution is to atomize human beings into units, functional units, and basically say, well, if we just declare that nobody steps outside their house and the government will print enough money for their salaries, and we will deliver food to their doorstep while they lock in for 2 weeks. This virus would die out. That's absolute fantasy. It's not just like a practical, you know, and then you try to talk to them about it, like, oh, well, what about the Constitution and their rights? And you're like, oh, rights are suspended during a pandemic because the rights are not a suicide pact. And I think that's malarkey. What a lot of people exhibit in this day and age is falling in love with an idea. Right, so Jordan Peterson, one of my favorite podcasters, has this concept of ideological possession, where people don't have ideas, right? It's instead ideas have people, meaning like an idea dies out when nobody takes it seriously anymore, right? And it doesn't get talked about, and it dies. It's like a spirit, or as Richard Dawkins would say, a meme, right? A Dawkinsian meme. A unit of thought, an idea, and people can get hung up on that. And then you have the sunk costs, where, you know, you look at the lockdowns. So we've been locked down for 5 weeks. What's another one? What's another two, or three, if we can kill this virus? But the truth is, like, nobody has confronted the idea that we can't, because we don't want to believe that we can't. But if you assume that you can't defeat this virus using quarantine, then you can move on to the next idea, is how do we live with this without killing off a million people? And nobody's talking about it just yet, because they're still hung up on the idea that, oh, hey, maybe if we just complied with this a little bit better, maybe if we just did this, you know, it's almost like Catholic guilt, right? Or like, you know, one of the things that I'm just going to say this, like, and this is going to be on the internet and it's going to be public and all that. When I didn't come out to my mom, right, I was 35 and I did not come out to my mom. Instead, my mom told me she knew about me.
Really?
Yes. And she kind of joked a little bit and said, so were you going to wait until I was in my deathbed before you told me? Like, what were you really afraid of, right? Were you afraid that I would withhold my love? Were you afraid that I would not treat you like my son? You're my son, right? That's what my mom, that's what my mom told me. And of course she goes into the usual Catholic stuff and it's like, oh, maybe you like want to have a woman and have children, you know, or at least find a way to have your own children somehow, maybe hold your nose and stuff like that. Dude, no, I kid you not. And my mom jokes about this. She's just like, why don't you just close your eyes, hold your nose, and hump your hips? And I'm just like, Mom, no.
I know she has the best intentions behind the comments, but that's funny.
Of course, it's hilarious. The number one thing that I actually, like, when I told her why, was because I was afraid that she would ask herself where she went wrong. And she is like. And then I told her that, and she said, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm not going to beat myself up about that. You're still my son, no matter, right? Like, but just don't die alone, because, you know, like, that's her number one advice. And I'm approaching 40. I turned 40 this year, dude. Like, it is starting to, like, scare me a little bit. I don't have children. I don't have a spouse. So when I plan for my retirement, I have to think about that stuff. What if I don't find someone? Right? How am I going to live? Like, what if I break a hip when I'm 67? Right?
Yeah.
Who's going to find me? Like if I die in bed, like, who's going to start asking, when was the last time JV called you? Right?
Yeah.
That's scary. But it is a reality that I have to confront. And that's the thing that everybody else, too. Like, I'm going to roll that right into the COVID lockdowns. The reality that people have to confront is that, oh, hey, like, we're not going to defeat this virus sitting down at home. Meanwhile, you've got 22 million recorded unemployed people. God knows how many gig economy workers can't even find any business for themselves at this point, right?
Yeah.
And I would never agitate for revolution, but yo, like, I will say this. I've posted this on Twitter a lot of times. Our media, our intelligentsia, and our politicians do not deserve the patience and grace of the American people. They don't.
I would agree with that.
They do not deserve the patience and grace of the American people. Because God, like, look at this. Like, they would rather, sure, they will go and gridlock Lansing. And they would protest, and they would have their signs. And yeah, sure, some of them crowded around, and sure, somebody picked up food. And maybe it would spread the plague a little bit more. But you know what? You know what didn't happen to Governor Whitmer yesterday or the other day? They didn't kill her.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you look at the kind of upheaval that is happening right now, and any lesser society would have probably taken her down, dragged her out in the street.
You kind of look at this is a terrible comparison. I'm going to go on record by saying this right now, but I mean, you look at like when Gaddafi was taken down.
Yes,
they dragged him in the street and killed him.
Yes, and
I mean, right, that's what we were hoping for. But still, that, I mean, that's, you look at other, if you look at gosh, and again, I got to balance this line very carefully, but non-first world countries,
sure,
they tend to be a little bit more violent, and they will be the ones who will go in a palace and, you know, bring out that dictator.
Yes.
And kill him in the streets.
Sure. And that's the thing, we remain a civilized people. We still believe in our own goodness and our own civilization, and honestly, we're also too lazy to do the cleanup.
That's,
you know,
true. We are.
You know, like, it's too messy. We still have faith in our institutions. It's still way too messy, like, for people to actually want that. But I'll tell you this much, man. If you have 60 million unemployed, that is 35% of the workforce. Wow. Things are going to start falling apart in terms of, like, okay, well, this farmer here no longer has a trucker to send his stuff to the 7-Eleven. The 7-Eleven has nothing to sell, and nobody has any money, right?
Yeah.
Multiple cascading failures across an entire national system. It's suicide. So, mm-hmm. like, I'm very happy that Trump came out with guidelines, guardrails to help governors. I'm glad mm-hmm. that he has deferred to the governors for that, because, you know, like, it basically is like what he needs to do. Like, he had zero power to shut things down. He made it very clear. And when he said, I think he was just joking around when he said that he had absolute authority to reopen the country, the truth was that he was just trying to get people to remind him that he doesn't have the power to reopen the states. And which also basically is a nice little flip. Now the critique against him closing the states is BS. And so I think that was a little bit of like gamesmanship in his part. Anybody who was taking it too seriously, please lighten up, right? Now there is one thing.
Yeah.
I know. And I can translate Trump for you if you want, and I know you probably won't like it. But I'll tell you what, man. The man knows how to flip a script. He really knows how to flip a script. And it's a little dirty. It's a little nasty because we want to believe.
A little dirty? A little nasty? How about it's a lot dirty.
It is. It is very dirty. But that's the thing. But we're so used to the kind of politics that we have had before that this is so, he is so generous about this. Like, he is like no other in that sense. Right? So he is able.
True.
He's able to flip scripts and turn things on their head that other people, he's able to expose the inconsistencies that, and the cognitive dissonance from other people. And the
hackers. But he's just as inconsistent.
He is. And I know. I'm not going to.
And
I'm
there's
not,
a lot of cognitive dissonance going on.
Oh, yeah. No, no, no. I'm not going to say that he's
yeah.
not. It's just that he's able to expose it in everybody else. And last,
you're right. No, you
and,
are.
And,
absolutely
and that's
right.
And that's the thing about him, is that he doesn't bring anybody else up. Instead, he brings everyone down. Like, the joke is that everything he touches is ruined. Look at some of the media people who are completely, completely consumed with TDS, right? Like, one person says, "Why can't you close the country?" And he says, "I don't have the power for that." So the next 3 days later, he says, "Only I have the power to open the country." And everybody says, "Well, you can't open the country." And then everybody is like, "Well, yeah." And so where is the critique about him closing the country coming from? right? So what is it really, right? And it's hilarious. It's fun to watch. It's fun to watch.
I'm glad you got some enjoyment. I can't stand the head games. I yearn for a simpler time.
Same. Believe it or not, same.
I do.
Me too. But I mean, it's exhausting.
It is. I wish we had what we used to have, but at the same time, if you really look at it, I mean, it's just they were just as dirty. They just used better words.
Yes,
you absolutely. Know they were smooth. Their delivery was. I mean, even W's delivery, for as yokel as you wanted to make him sound, I mean, he knew how to connect.
Yeah.
And you knew how to get to the heartstrings of people, and if you really attacked him, you really came more off as petty than he did.
Yeah, so that is W's superpower.
That was W's superpower. Now, but with Trump, it's like he comes off as petty, extremely petty. But then you have the media, which at times I think they actually are asking fair questions. But he gets so under their skin, it's like they crumble to his level and then beneath his level, and it's a sinkhole. The media and Trump are a giant sinkhole, and they're taking everyone down with them, and I hate that. And I guess that's why I wish that, can we just go back to the sneaky, you know, conniving politicians that we used to have, where at least they told us we were nice? And then screwed us behind our backs, you know, that kind of thing.
As I've said, the guy is sui generis, man. Like, there will never be another president like Trump, and he is the only one of his kind. Like,
no, he's opened the door. He's opened the door. I mean, you're right. He will always be the first. He has changed politics forever in this country, and I don't know if there will ever be another like him. But he's opened up the door for people like him. It's just that the Democrats haven't found their person. And okay, the Republicans, for better or worse, literally stumbled into Trump. I mean, they didn't want him.
They did. Like, he could have won the Democratic election. Like, he could have won as a Democrat.
He could, because he is.
He's
a Democrat. But whatever, he is a Democrat. Okay, I still maintain, despite the judges, despite everything else, the man is a Democrat. Everything he said is, well, you know what, I take it back, he's not a Democrat, he's a Trump. He's about himself. He's going to do whatever it takes, he's going to say whatever it takes to get what he wants. And I mean, we all know that Trump didn't even think he was going to win. All he wanted to do was use this as an opportunity to launch his own TV station,
right?
And I'm going to stop now, because I try not to make this an anti-Trump podcast. My listeners will know where I stand. I think it's fairly obvious. But I try not to make this an anti-Trump podcast, because I believe that there are probably some people out there who are going on their own political journey, and right now they're questioning things, but they still are like, well, you know, Trump, but, you know, I don't want them to be thrust into a corner that they may not have gone into simply because they heard me being so virulent about being anti-Trump. And so I'm not going to be. I will acknowledge that he has had some successes, that he's done some things right, albeit not the way that I wished he would have.
So that's about, yeah. There is one question that you did ask of me before I came on here that I would love to share.
Absolutely, yes.
And we're talking about the road trip and the playlists.
Yes. Oh, I was definitely going to be getting to this. This is my main feature on the show.
Okay. All right.
Truth be told, I actually already have your graphic made. the JV playlist. So.
Oh man.
Because I say a good road trip always deserves a good playlist. So who or what is on your playlist?
So, I am a very big fan of musical scores.
Okay, yeah.
Especially when I work, I have a couple of very. I'm going to look at Spotify. So if I'm not looking at the camera,
you're right ahead. No, I'm going to be writing this down, so I'm going to be looking away too. So.
Okay. So, my listening habit is that I am very like I allow certain songs and pieces, you know, I'll call them songs even though there's no lyrics. They're still songs in popular parlance, and that's the other thing too, is I'm very picky about my words. I have a listening habit where I either listen to one song on loop or an album on loop. Like I'm a looper like that, because things fade into the background, and then as they do, certain layers of the music emerge that you don't hear in the first time. Right?
You're an old school listener.
A little bit.
You know?
Yeah.
And I appreciate that about you. Well, I mean, I used to be the kind of person who would just put on an album and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that. And now everything's on shuffle, and I can't get the same enjoyment that I used to.
So
I don't know why.
I'm not a big shuffler guy. I don't curate my playlist either. Like order doesn't matter so much as simply knowing what's next, right?
Yeah.
So I don't shuffle. But I'll add to a playlist, and then if I'm familiar with the playlist, like when I hear a song, even when I'm not listening to my playlist, I expect the next song to come up. Right, so that's kind of like how I work when it comes to listening habits. So scores, like musical scores, number one that I would recommend, especially if you're trying to think, especially if you are working on coding, because I am a web developer for now.
Mm-hmm.
There is the soundtrack to The Sims 4.
Sims 4. Okay.
Yes. The Sims 4. The official artist on Spotify is EA Games, but the musician, the scorer is by a guy named Ilan Eshkeri, right? And this guy scored a movie called Stardust with Claire Danes, mm-hmm, and Charlie Cox. A very beautiful score as well. Star Trek Picard. The musical score to Starter Picard will wiggle its way in your head.
Really?
It will wiggle its way in your head, and you will find yourself hearing it even though you're not listening to it. It has that quality. So other stuff. I'm a child of the 90s and 2000s, you know, like I have and it's very eclectic. I've got, you know, adult alternative, also known as the Sarah McLachlan genre. I have Alanis. I mean, I have Vanessa Williams. You know, I have random stuff in my 90s and 2000s favorites. I listen to a lot of bands. I hate DJs, unfortunately. Like, they bore me.
That's fine.
Well, I'm friends with DJs. It's just that the music bores me, right? Because I'm just like, all right, there's not as much craftsmanship to this, and that is probably my biggest Ben Shapiro style line. Like, okay, boomer me on this one, is that there's so little craftsmanship involved in DJing. You know, okay, like I have a Mac, I have Pro Tools, and I'm just gonna layer clips together. Yay, right?
My music critic in me is rejoicing with you at the same time, because I mean, so I, just to slightly deviate here, so I saw a band called Glass Animals a couple years ago.
Okay,
if you haven't checked them out, you should. They are fantastic. But they had a DJ. And if they are a legit band, they play instruments, they have some beats, you know, but they are a legit band with you know, who goes up there. But they had a DJ, a Swedish DJ, open for them. And all this guy was doing, he was up there, and he was just turning his little knobs, you know, dancing his little jig up there, doing a little bit of this, you know. And occasionally, you know, he'd lean down, pick up a guitar, you know, do a little strum here and there and loop it, and I'm like, this isn't music creativity. But at the same time, in their defense, I mean, I've kind of succumbed to that. There is a creative element to DJing the DJing, because you have to put these puzzle pieces together. But at the same time, I'm just like, yeah, you're just sitting in front of a laptop of Pro Tools and just layering stuff. I mean, come on.
So there is a very, like, so the DJs, before Pro Tools and Macs became super duper affordable, there was this golden age of DJs, right? So you have from 1997 to about 2006.
Mm-hmm.
9 years.
Well, I'm like Chemical Brothers, Prodigy.
Chemical Brothers, Prodigy, Armin van Buuren, Tiesto.
Yeah.
So all these people were actually spinning records, right? So cool. I'm good with that, right? Because they are timing stuff, and they do know how to time stuff and all that, and it's great. And if they make mistakes, but I will say this about DJs, especially if you're, if it's. The music is not what you're producing really when you're DJing, and I will say this, it is an interaction with the crowd, and it is almost like it's almost like shamanism, right? Like you're able to produce a sensory experience that a crowd reacts to. And if you're looking from the outside, the true instrument of the DJ is the crowd. Like the true expression of his ability is the ability to have a crowd react to what he is doing, and I have to give them credit for that. Now, if you're talking purely about music and the craftsmanship of it, but if you know, like, for example, God, I don't like that group, the Chainsmokers. The Chainsmokers are great at layering sounds, and they produce, they're famous for their tracks, and I'll never take that away from them, but I will never go to their live shows because their live shows are terrible and they don't connect to their audience. And more on music a little bit more.
You're good.
I mean, like, I'm just like all over the place, and it's been an hour and a half. I hope it's not too long for your listeners.
It's okay. Yeah, we'll probably break it up into a couple episodes. It's all right. I did an interview. No kidding. So next week's show, I recorded last night, and that went like a couple hours. So
okay,
you know.
Okay.
So you're all good. You're all
okay.
Good.
So a couple more artists that I want to give a shout out to. Ramin Djawadi, who scored Game of Thrones and has scored Westworld, and also scored Pacific Rim. Like, I will listen to almost anything that he has. And when I do drive, when I'm driving, that's when I listen to podcasts, right? So let me look at my podcasts here. Shows on podcasts. Big fan of Jocko Willink. If you've heard of him, I have the pitchiest voice, and the thing is, like, this guy is super duper gruff. Like, this is the Jocko podcast, episode number 5, and it's just like and he'll read books about military history and then talk about current events, and sometimes he'll have guests who are like, you know, like Korean War veterans or something crazy that. Yeah, Vietnam War veterans, and he'll have them as guests, and he talks about military leadership. He gives lectures and gets paid big bucks to give leadership lectures to the corporate teams. That's how he makes a lot of his money. There's a guy, his name is Andy Frisella. He had a podcast called The MF CEO Project. It is like a 200 episode podcast about entrepreneurship, and he's really good. I like his ideas. His delivery is very emphatic, meaning like he's very forceful, and some people, it is a very acquired taste for some people, because people don't like getting talked at. But he has a couple of guests. He's based out of Kansas City, Missouri, I believe, and he'll have two guests in the studio whenever they do their podcast. He sells supplements, so he is a real entrepreneur. He has products, he has a warehouse, but he changed his podcast from the MFCO Project to Real AF, which is just basically him and his two friends shooting the, you know, like, spending time talking about life and current events. Some of them are very Trumpy. One of them's anti-Trump, but ultimately they reflect a lot of like the practical pragmatism, like the practical politics that I believe in now, right? So it's not like, oh, what is the Republican thing to do or what is the conservative thing to do? No, because he is a business guy and a real business guy. Well, you know, he focuses on what is both the proximate and the long term outcome, right? So they're mm-hmm. outcome based arguments. More podcasts. Shout out to Andrew Klavan, super funny. He and Michael Knowles, out of the four Daily Wire podcasts, are who I listen to. Ben's great, but he's not like my daily cup of tea, and I can't stand that much. I didn't want to pick a fight with them because, like, I'm friends with one of their producers, Elisha Krause, if you're familiar with her from back in the day. So Daily Wire also owns, or at least is associated with, Esoteric Radio, and you have the Cold War, What We Saw, and Apollo 11, What We Saw, narrated by Bill Whittle. And Bill Whittle is one of those old school bloggers from 2001 and 2002 that I continue to listen to, right? And last but not the least, you know, I mean, like, Jordan Peterson really is well known for 12 Rules for Life and all his lectures, but the thing that I will say the most about this guy, dig into his earliest podcasts where he goes through mythology, where he goes uh-huh. through the psychology of Genesis, like the biblical book. He had one lecture for each book of Genesis. And he picks it apart. Yep. And I am working through a book called Maps of Meaning, which is a very long book, and it's just basically a psychology approach to you know, the mythology and the religions that we have right now, how we handle symbols. And I could go on for hours about his stuff. You know, but yeah, so that's in the podcast stuff. Music again. A lot of soundtracks more than anything else. A lot of bands like Taking Back Sunday, Yellow Card, if anybody remembers them. You know, and then you have the pop punk revival, or actually like emergence around 2005-06. There's a band called All Time Low, if I remember that one.
I vaguely remember them. Yeah.
You know, so my tastes in music are very eclectic.
Well, this playlist is going to be very eclectic.
It is very eclectic, you know, and vocalists. I do love female singers. You know, I do love good pipes, but also vocal groups. Like, so there's a band called Shepherd. Shepard. Shepherd has a song called Geronimo that I love a lot. And then this dude, like, has the best voice. I have a crush on his voice. His name's Brian Fallon.
Okay.
And I think that he was associated with the band Gaslight Anthem. So he was the So Brian Fallon is the lead singer of Gaslight Anthem, and he has a solo project because some of his songs that he wants to write aren't part of the band's brand.
Yeah.
So it's good stuff. And yeah, so Brian Fallon, you know, and some of it is, again, I'm not a snob. I don't consider myself sophisticated, and that's one of those things that I want to believe is one of my better qualities, is that I'm not a snob. Random stuff. There's a song called Houses by a band called Great Northern.
I am aware of Great Northern. Yes. I have their first album.
So they're
a super group. They're great.
Are they? Yeah, they have the song from, they used the song in a scene from The Magicians, and it's one of my favorite shows. It's been canceled. I mean, it ended. The story was finished. But it was good. But yeah, like if anyone wants to like dig through, you know, the playlist that you're going to put together for my recommendations, that'll be great.
Yeah,
it'll be fun.
Just throwing it out, the Great Northern, the one album that I have of theirs, it's called Trading Twilight for Daylight.
Okay.
Came out in 2007, and I only found out about them because iTunes, Apple used to do this free song of the week.
Okay.
I don't know if they still do it. Yeah. They used to do this, and their song Home was a free song of the week, and I got that, and I was like, holy cow, this is really good. And that's actually one of the few times that I got a whole album based off of the free single of the week, and I love the entire album. They have a female singer, they have a male singer, they go back and forth. That album, I'll have to check out their other stuff, but that album I love, absolutely love.
So I pick up a lot of songs by watching TV shows because I love music supervisors. They always have like this huge library of music that they can find the right passage from at the right moment, at the right emotion.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how do they geek out? Like the kind of, like, that kind of broad knowledge and the ability to apply it in an applicable situation blows my mind.
I would love a job like that because I've listened to so much music and been in so many conversations where someone says something, and I know the line from the song that should go with this.
Right, right. And to have that kind of library, because that's a heuristic library, right? Like, that is a series of okay, this works 80% of the time. This is going to work in this situation 70% of the time. And I'm pretty sure that if you're a music supervisor, you probably have your top 100 songs that you're going to use for every comedy, top 100 songs that you're going to use for every drama. But the fact that you can figure out the particular section of that song that you're going to put at this moment, right, it just blows my mind. Like, especially when you watch DVDs, not streaming, of House. House and Suits have introduced a lot of music into my playlist just by watching them. But yeah, I'm good. Like, I think I've shared plenty, and I hope that
you've overwhelmed.
I hope it's been fun, man. Like, I hope you had fun. I hope you had fun talking. And
I did. No, this has been great. This has been great. Just real quick, as we wrap up here.
Yeah.
And maybe you do, maybe you don't. But if you want people to find you on Twitter.
Oh gosh.
Do you want people to find you on Twitter anymore?
I guess no. I mean, like, it's still a public account. It's One Fine J. It's ONEFINEJAY. I'm not a big follow back guy. Like, the funny thing is, like, if you talk to me enough, if you respond to me enough in a way that's not rude or stupid or bad faith argument, I'm probably going to end up following you. If you're not horrible to other people, if you're not mean to other people, I'm going to end up following you. But I don't, I haven't looked at my follower account in a long time. I haven't reviewed who's been following me, and really, like, whether it's COVID or anything else, like, if you want to see how I approach situations with regards to current events in politics, like, for me, like, politics is no longer about a particular party winning or you know, more so, like, especially in a crisis situation where we're at, maybe next year, right? Maybe next year when Trump gets reelected, we can revisit where we're at. Maybe when things are a little bit less tumultuous, Maybe you can finally start talking about how, oh great, like, this is not a very conservative thing that Trump's doing, and we'd like it to get scaled back a little bit. But right now, you know, like, there's just way too much stuff going on. But again, my Twitter's there. I don't blog anymore. I'm not a published writer. You will not find me in Red State. You will not find me in The Federalist. You will not find me in any published publication.
Just on Twitter and occasionally.
Just on Twitter for now. And I might self-publish. I'm working on a couple of media projects myself, and that's one of the reasons.
Very cool. Well, maybe we'll have to have you back on when you get those projects finished.
Absolutely. And if you don't, like, you know, at some point, I'm not ready to announce anything just yet. And
that's
fine.
But
I wanted to do this, and maybe I can be a guest, even a short one, to help me launch this thing. Yeah.
I would love to have you back on. Absolutely.
I hope you had fun, man. Like, I know that this wasn't necessarily, like, we didn't really talk too much about politics per se.
That's okay. That's the beauty of the podcast, the beauty of the conversation.
Yeah.
That I wanted this to be a conversation, right? And that's what we got. And that's what I try to promote to my listeners. I don't refer to these things as interviews.
Right.
Just two people talking.
Yeah. Well, in that case, I had a great time talking to you.
Thank you. I did too. Just one final thing that I have to say, because, again, we're friends on Facebook, so I see your stuff come across my feed, and you mentioned your mom earlier. I love seeing photos of you and your mom. You can tell that it is a very special relationship between you two guys.
Thank you.
And it wasn't that long ago that she became a citizen herself. Am I correct in that?
So I became a citizen in 2017, and she naturalized in 2015.
Okay.
Or
okay.
2016. Yeah.
That's all so cool. That's very cool.
That's awesome, man.
Well, to wrap up, you can find this podcast at joshgillespie.com. You can also find it on all the major podcasting outlets on Google, Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, TuneIn, name it, I'm there. Sign up for the newsletter. I tell people to always sign up for the newsletter, joshgillespie.com. There you will get the link to the playlist of JV's playlist and all the playlists for my previous guests. That's the incentive to sign up for the newsletter. You want to hear what this guy is listening to? Sign up for the playlist, or sign up for the newsletter. You can do that at joshgillespie.com. Follow us on Twitter at The Nomad Pod, and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheNomadPod. We're also on Instagram, The Political Nomad there. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you've watched a very long video, but I hope you've enjoyed it. So click and subscribe to this channel, like the video, click the little bell so that you can get a reminder every time we post a new video. And again, I want to say a big time thank you to my long time and yet very new friend, JV Avellano. Thanks again for being on this week, JV.
Hey, thank you for having me, Josh. You take care.
You too, sir. You've been listening to The Political Nomad. We'll be back next week.
Bye now.